Tonight on Arena, Alanis Morissette, Mary Chapin Carpenter and Lila Moss are the albums up for review. And we talk to the poet, Michael Longley. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. The Candlelight Master is a new collection from Michael Longley, the Belfast poet best known for award-winning works such as Gorse Fires, The Weather in Japan and The Stairwell. His latest books revisits themes Longley has made his own over the years, including war from the ancient Greeks to the present day and the natural world. While other poems are addressed to friends and family and to other artists. Michael Longley joins me now from Belfast. So nice to talk to you, Michael.
And to you.
Michael, the collection, as I said, is called The Candlelight Master. What is a Candlelight Master?
Well, the Candlelight Master was a Baroque master of painting. He was a master of candlelight effects. Nobody knows his name. So because of his candlelight skills, he's known as the Candlelight Master. And in a way, I adopt his persona with a mixture of pride and humility, I hope. It's a very short poem.
Yes.
Shall I read it?
Please do, Michael, yes.
I am the Candlelight Master, striking a match in the shadows. A smoky wick, then radiance. I am the Candlelight Master. It doesn't need to be any longer than that.
No, indeed it doesn't. So so you go from the smoky wick then to radiance. So that's your job, really.
I suppose that's what art should do. Yes, I think so.
Now, you make the parallel a lot in the collection between the role of the visual artist and the poet. Even before we get into the poems, you quote Juan Miro in when he says, "And what looks like a zigzag is really a straight line." Why that line from Miro?
Oh, well, it's meant to be suggestive. I suppose what I'm saying or implying is that this may look like a jumble of poems, but underneath it's a straight line. It's not a zigzag. It's a straight line. There's some kind of coherence to this miscellany of poems.
So the Candlelight Master knows where he's going, so just stick with him.
That's right, yeah.
So the opening poems are about painters. There's Matisse trying to complete a mosaic by getting his assistants to put the little pieces of beautiful paper in certain positions. Then there's Pierre Bonnard, who's bedbound and he's relying on his nephew to just change a few things in the painting. And then you have the image of William Orpen poised at the rim of a bomb crater. Is that what it's like? Are you talking about the older poet there, Michael? Are you making parallels between yourself and these artists?
Well, yes, I am interested in the art that the older people might produce. You know, the Matisse was confined to a wheelchair, and he didn't have very long to live, and yet he produced some of his greatest work. And Bonnard, I admire enormously, and he was anxious about a particular painting when he was bedbound, and got his nephew to add a little bit of colour. I think poetry, the arts, if you like, poetry is produced by young people. And also by old people, by the pensioners. And I think of Verdi and Janáček and Thomas Hardy and W.B. Yeats. I'm now 81, for God's sake. And yet, since Christmas, I have written more poems than I would normally write in 2 or 3 years. And that gives me enormous pleasure and satisfaction. And in a way, that poem I read salutes that fact, you know, the still at it at 81.
And do you approach writing poetry in a different way? There, Matisse is looking for his assistants to help him. Bonnard is also looking for his nephew. I mean, you have no need of assistance. So do you see any parallels in inspiration or the way you approach poetry?
No, I have to wait for poems. I once said, and it has been quoted, I modestly say, that if I knew where poems came from, I would go there. Well, I don't know. I really don't. I have no idea. I mean, there were 10 years in my 40s, nearly 10 years, when I didn't write a damn thing. And I don't know. I don't know where the muse disappeared to. And I don't know why she came back. And I really sit with my fingers crossed, hoping that the muse doesn't desert me ever again. But, I mean, at the moment, I mean, I touch wood when I say this, at the moment, the poems are coming. And I have to wait for them. And in my youth, I used to work very hard. And I think that was because I started to write a poem too soon, and it had to go into an incubator like a premature baby. Now my sense of timing, I think, is better, and I write when the poem seems ready to be born, and it's oddly satisfying not to have to work quite so laboriously as I used to. In fact, writing poems at the moment in my life is a joyous and happy and relatively carefree experience.
That's wonderful. That is just wonderful. There's a poem called The Sedge Warblers, and that's a bird that some people call the Irish nightingale. Is that right?
Yes, I think so. Certainly in my poem, they do. Do you want me to read this one?
Yes. Do you want to tell us the connection with your friend first of all, or would you like to read it first and tell us then?
No. I'll say that it's about my dear friend Seamus Heaney, and as most people know, he's buried in a little place called Ballaghy. And in the poem, I refer to Callimachus, an ancient Greek poet, and his lamentation for his friend Heraclitus, sedge warblers. Callimachus joins me at your grave, who shed tears for Heraclitus, and said his poems were nightingales that death would never lay hands on. There are no nightingales in Ireland, but sedge warblers sometimes sing at night and are mistaken for nightingales. So death, that snatches at everything, will leave untouched in Ballaghy your poems, the sedge warblers' song.
That's lovely. That's lovely. That's the sedge warblers from Michael Longley's new collection, which is called The Candlelight Master. Michael, you return to themes you've explored in your poetic life, that of war, and you go back to the Trojan Wars and the Iliad by Homer, and you talk about the interfamily murder that happened there in the poems War, Glory and Xenotus. What is it you're exploring there again in this collection?
Well, I'm obsessed by war, partly because my dad fought in two world wars. Well, he fought in the trenches in the First World War, and he served again. He joined up again in the Second World War, and he was a brave soldier. He was decorated, and I wish I'd talked more to him. So a lot of my poems are the conversations with him that I wish I had had. And then I find, as a sounding board, The Iliad is a quite extraordinary work of art, and I think it's the greatest poem, certainly the greatest poem that I know about war and death. And these themes, combining as they do in some of my poems, are for me bottomless, endless, and I'll be writing such poems, I trust and hope, until the end of my life.
You also have a great love of the natural world, and I know you love the West of Ireland. The poem you're going to read now is called Prince. Tell us a little bit about that before you read it.
Well, again, it's rather short, you know. Among the guardian spirits of Corrigskeewaun, the little place where we go, among the guardian spirits are the otters we see from time to time, blessedly beautiful creatures. And this is about discovering on the strand about a dozen otter prints coming from God knows where and going God knows where. Mysterious. Prince. Between sand dunes and sea, under a cloudless sky, a dozen otter prints going nowhere, it seems. Mwilray in the distance, white after last night's fall. Where will the otter go out of the blue this day, over the sand and snow?
Prince there from The Candlelight Master by Michael Longley. Michael, elsewhere there's poems that touch on family and also poems that explore the memories of your childhood. Like, I was fascinated by primary school, where you were really picturing being back in the classroom. And there you talked about your twin brother. And I think you have elegized him in a previous collection, The Stairwell. But you write a beautiful poem about him, your twin brother, in the poem Brothers. He is a constant presence in your life, isn't he?
Well, being a twin's a big deal, and losing a twin is a big deal. And we went our separate ways as teenagers and as young men. I went to Trinity and started to try to be a poet. He was a marine engineer traveling the world in oil tankers. And but the mysterious and wonderful thing for me was that as we got older, as we went into middle age, and we realized how much we had in common, and we got closer. And I was with him when he died. I was holding his hand when he died, and I thought at the time I would love to write an elegy for him. And lo and behold, I managed to write 23 elegies for Peter, which appeared in that book you mentioned, The Stairwell. This poem called Brother quotes from a famous poem by the Latin poet Catullus, with the famous motto, Hail and Farewell. I'll read it for you now.
Thank you.
Brother. That Catullus line, Multas pergentes, applies to you, my marine engineer, circumnavigating the globe, and me following you in my imagination across many a sea to speak in vain to your ashes. My twin, torn from my life, accept this elegy wet with my weeping. Steer your tanker towards eternity. Greetings, dear sailor, my brother, goodbye.
That's wonderful. Brother there from The Candlelight Master, read by Michael Longley. My thanks to Michael Longley, and The Candlelight Master is published by Jonathan Cape. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. Well, as part of Kilkenny Arts Festival, portrait artist Blaise Smith will be giving audiences the opportunity to watch how he works online. Village People is his portrait project that will see him sketch and paint members of his own community of Dungarvan, County Kilkenny. The sittings will be broadcast online and the sketches will form part of a full portrait series that Blaise will work on over the coming years. And Blaise joins me now from his home in Dungarvan. Blaise, you're a landscape and a portrait painter. How did Village People, how did that project come about?
I've been thinking about it really for 10 or 15 years, and I often paint communities, often linked by work. So I've painted county council workers, people in the army, I've painted in a school, and done lots of portraits of all the people in these places. And I thought to myself, I really ought to paint my own, you know, just ordinary Irish people. And I thought, well, I might as well, I'll pick a village. And then I thought, well, I might as well pick my own village, really. It's much more convenient than, you know. And really, I just thought as well, there's lots and lots of paintings of the great and the good, as it were, in museums and galleries and in institutions. And I'm lucky enough, I have to admit, to get to do some of those portrait commissions, you know.
So and, how does this work, Blaise? How did you decide? Did you advertise or do you invite people? Or how do you choose who you're going to paint?
Well, now, just let's be clear. I'm in Dungarvan in Kilkenny. So this is a pub, a shop and a church. And it's not Dungarvan in Waterford, which I presume has a population of about 5,000, maybe 10,000 people.
So the choice is more limited. Is that what you're saying?
Very limited. I'd say there's about, there's about 25 houses in the village. Obviously, being an Irish village, it spreads out. There is no end to it, I suppose. So really, really, I'm trying to make things easy for myself as well, as, you know, on an interpersonal spaces. So I will pick people I know to begin with, you know, and I know that they're chatty and easygoing, and also that they'll agree to this, which is a kind of a big ask. Will
big
you
ask,
sit there
yes.
for me for to begin with 4 hours, you know? And now we've added the extra little dimension of saying, would you mind if I bring a camera? In fact, would you mind if I bring a couple of cameras? And would you mind if I broadcast straight out live to who knows?
And where is
there,
the venue?
You know?
Is this in your own studio? Is that where people will come?
Well, there was a discussion about that. I always paint people in their own homes when I'm doing this, you know, as a commission, because you obviously get huge amounts of information about somebody from what they have in their own house. And I just think people would find that interesting. So I've decided where possible, in other words, where they have a good enough broadband connection, I'm going to do it from their own homes, you know, or their workplace. So that'll be kind of interesting for people to see in. It's a bit like, you know, when you go into other people's homes on television, I suppose, yeah, that's half the fascination is.
Yes, like when they're painting the Queen, she sits on her throne.
Yes, but sometimes they, you know, they just paint her head, you know, and I feel that's not as informative as painting people in their context. I suppose I'm interested in being in making a document, like a documentary thing about showing people in all their, with all the stuff they have around them, because that kind of tells you a lot about them. So, for example, I painted Bernard Farrell, the playwright for The Abbey, a few years ago. And somebody said to me afterwards, well, it's the only portrait where the writer is seen in his writing room, you know, with all his files and his desk and stuff. Most of the portraits in The Abbey have a much more neutral background. You know,
it's not necessarily
there. But I feel all that stuff is really interesting. In fact, in the portrait of Bernard, for example, I was able to put on a little play in front of him on the desk. I you know, he had a little set design, so we were able to put that on the desk. So there was a little, and there was a couple of chairs and a little table, and you know, it was like as if we had a play within a play. So in that sense, that says a lot about him going for, and I would like to do the same thing with people that I know in the village, you know. So there's, you know, Eddie Fenlon. He runs I thought he just drove a taxi, but actually he runs a big taxi firm, all from a house in Dungarvan, because he has good broadband and he's controlling most of the taxis in Kilkenny and also in Naas now, you know, from his house with several employees there. So there's all screens set up in a sort of a control centre they have in his house. So that's kind of interesting.
So you're going to set him up in his control centre?
Yes, exactly. And then there's, you know, there's Charlie Brennan, quite a near neighbor, like actually almost next door, and he's a teenager, and he has a flock of his Wartable sheep, which are those brown, dark sheep with the white noses, and he bought the first of those from his confirmation money, I think. And I would dearly love to paint him with his sheep. So.
And how would you manage that?
You might have to tie the sheep up for a bit.
Okay.
I don't know. I might do the sheep. Well, I'm probably not going to do the sheep this time. But I was thinking, because I was just looking at the sheep less than half an hour ago, thinking, will he bring one up to the house? You know where the broadband is. We could just bring one up, and you know maybe we'll get it in the background. You know, that'll be nice. You know. So, I'm really looking forward to doing all these portraits because also people talk to you, they tell you amazing stuff as you're going along, you know. And
then you've a woman called Anne Porter. She's into horses.
Yes, yeah. She's a great character, Anne, very chatty, very interesting. But, you know, telling me all sorts of stuff about horses. We were discussing about whether we loved our professions today. When I called down just to confirm with her today, and she said, you know, people always ask me, do you love horses? And I was going, yeah, people always ask me, do I love painting? And both of us said, no, we love it when it works, you know, but really we just, you know, it's a job most of the time, but people expect you to love this, but you're just kind of saying, like, I'm working at it. And there are great joys when it pans out. But she also talked about how, with young horses, it's really exciting and fantastic. You think it's going to be the greatest racehorse ever. She trains horses, you know. And I was going, I have the same feeling about paintings. And then, you know, the busload of compromises arrives up and you just have to, you know, just keep working. And surprisingly enough, some of the paintings turn out really well. But you don't possibly realise that in the middle of the struggle to make it.
And Blaise, I can see from the way you were talking about interacting there with Anne and Charlie, what is it going to be like then if there's going to be a camera on you? Is that relationship with the sitter is obviously key to painting?
I was just thinking earlier on, you know, because I was getting nervous about going on the radio. I was thinking maybe people are less nervous now when a camera comes out, because one thing that surprised me when I asked all the people who are participating in this from the village, could I bring a camera with me? They all said, yeah, fine. And there was no worry about that. And I think that may be that just people are now more used to cameras being pulled out at every occasion and them being video. So maybe they're more easygoing with the situation. So I think, you know, from my point of view as a painter, I mean, I can tell you that this last couple of days, the whole video side of this is kind of nearly taking over. It'll be great when I actually just get to do the painting, you know, it'll be quite easy, you know. but the who'd have thought, you know, when I was in art college 30 years ago, that we were all going to have to be able to basically broadcast ourselves or present ourselves, run our own internal PR firms. You know, and it's not just, this was before the pandemic. If anything, the COVID thing and the lockdown has made me do things I was saying I was going to do for several years. You know, I was always saying I should really begin making decent videos of what I'm doing. I should take that side of, you know, presenting my work more seriously.
And Blaise, when you're talking to the sitter, it's 4 hours. Do you talk to them? Is it a more meditative, calmer area at time, or how would you describe that time between the painter and the sitter?
I generally chat away and I ask them things, and then they give me always amazing answers, which leads to more questions always, of course. And I think people in the past who have been commissioned to paint have told me that it's a very interesting experience because they get into an introspective space about themselves because they're being looked at by me. And I'm trying to portray them, you know, and generally in the best light possible, in the best way possible for them. And then they begin thinking about themselves. And someone told me it becomes a very introspective kind of process, like, you know, who am I? What am I doing? Where's all this going? And that's happened a few times. And I think that's an interesting space for us all to be in as the painting is being made. And the painting is the kind of the, you know, the catalyst for that.
Indeed, but process. I think you've whet our appetite to be tuning in online to be able to watch the process. Blaise Smith, thank you so much. Village People is on as part of the Kilkenny Arts Festival, and that's kilkennyarts.ie for more details. And it's time now for album reviews. And the Canadian superstar Alanis Morissette is back with her latest release, album number 7 since the all-conquering Jagged Little Pill 20 years ago. The new album is called Such Pretty Forks in the Road. Next up, British singer Lila Moss continues her musical adventure in mixing all forms of music from folk to electronic with her latest release, Who the Power. And finally, American country singer-songwriter Mary Chapin Carpenter today releases her 17th album in her 33-year career. It's called The Dirt and the Stars. Nadine O'Regan and Simon Marr have been listening. And let's start with Alanis Morissette. This is a single from the current album, Such Pretty Forks in the Road, and this is called Ablaze.
Are your innocence in fire when you reach out? I am here, hell or high water. This nest is never going away. My mission is to keep the light in your eyes ablaze. And this cold.
That's Ablaze from Such Pretty Forks in the Road from Alanis Morissette. Nadine O'Regan and Simon Marr have been listening to the album for us. Nadine, this is her first album in 8 years, but there's no mistaking that voice is there.
No, it's like a time capsule, isn't it? You listen to Alanis Morissette and wherever you were in 1995 when Jagged Little Pill was released, you're suddenly right back there again. And I remember very clearly getting that album and at the start not being sure of it, and then suddenly it was just on repeat in the house. And she's such an interesting songwriter because actually a lot of her lines don't scan very well. They're a little bit clunky, and she says things like anatomy, and she makes that work in a lyric, and then it makes you listen to the line because it's so unusual. And in some ways, what other people would disregard as being the kind of words that you would probably remove from a song because they don't scan, Alanis is like, not only am I putting them in, I'm going to go further. We're going to have the self-analysis. We're going to be probing. And it's been the hallmark for sound, and it remains so here.
There is a lot of self-analysis in this album, isn't there?
There really is. She's spared nothing, really. And, you know, whether she's talking about addiction, alcoholism, the track actually you've just heard is about her children, so it's one of the sweeter tracks. But also she's getting into stuff like embezzlement, you know, problems with former managers, concerns about her marriage. You know, every single track is a very big story.
Simon, we were talking about Jagged Little Pill there, which was a Broadway show. But I mean, is she very defined by that one album, or has her output changed a lot over the years?
I think she definitely would have been for a long time afterwards. And there was quite a bit of after the album's success. And I remember going to see her in the SFX, probably 1996 or thereabouts. But there was a lot of, is this it? Is it going to be a one-trick pony? Is it just going to be anger from now on? And I think she possibly wasn't overly comfortable with that idea of being seen as the angry young woman, because I think she was only 20 when that album was released and was written. And it took her quite a while then to come back around to a point where I think she was kind of comfortable enough with herself to be able to say, hang on a minute, anger in this context was great, and it really, really helped me and it fueled me. It's like the old public image limited thing of anger is an energy. Whereas now, 25 years later, here we are, and it's a lot more, it's introspective as well as retrospective as well. So she's looking back on a lot of the things that have happened to her. And it's interesting because probably an awful lot of what goes on this album is a lot more based on experience, right? Whereas the original, whereas Jagged Little Pill back in 1995 was based on stories or, you know, creations of hers rather than things that had actually happened.
So Nadine mentioned Reasons I Drink there. So that's a song about addiction. But it's a very understanding song about addiction, isn't it? It's not waving the finger.
No, and that's one of the good things that's about this, and it's one of the reasons why an album like this works so well, is that it's not like one of those, you know, I drank and now I don't, and I'm not like the best person in the world now, and if you're still drinking, then you're a terrible person. It was really just, this is it, this is the reason why I do this, this is what I get from it. So it's, to, I suppose, to heighten people's understanding of it, rather than trying to either justify it, or, you know, climb on the high moral ground about it. And I think that's the sort of thing that makes this album work.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, I suppose, I think there are a lot of things here that are really strong and good. But in a way, the one of the problems for me with the record is actually me. It's not her, it's me, which sounds terrible. But it's because I go into this time capsule and I remember the 90s. And unfortunately, because the way she has always recorded her material is that her voice is so central and her emotion is so central. So she never really amps up the strings or does like a long kind of interlude where it's just music and no Alanis. So for me, because I go back down the rabbit hole into my youth, I get really stuck in that. And then I find myself saying things like, is it dated? And actually, I don't think it necessarily is a problem that it's dated. I think the production is fairly on point, but she has remained very much herself. It is a very, very identifiable 90s sound from Alanis, albeit with a slightly shinier production that suits 2020.
Right, but the sentiment is more mellow in it. Would
oh,
you?
It is. Yeah, it's definitely more sedate and downbeat. There's less of, you know, bad behaviour in the cinema and more of, I suppose, the mid-tempo ballad where she reflects on life. And I think that can also be a bit of a sticking point for the record, because if you think about the likes of Jagged Little Pill, there were highs and lows, tracks that were very simple and then tracks like You Ought to Know that were very angry. And while it's probably desperately unfair to compare her to a record that's now on its, what, 25th anniversary release, she was meant to be touring around the world in support of that anniversary. At the same time, it is worth saying that we do need dimension on the record and variety in light and shade. And there's something about the beat of this, the fact that she sticks to the same kind of register throughout, that can become a little tricky.
Okay, let's listen to Reasons I Drink.
Nothing can give a breakthrough.
Reasons I Drink there from Such Pretty Forks in the Road by Alanis Morissette. Simon Marr, do you think do you agree with what Nadine said there? She said they're all a bit the same register. And you do notice there the way by hook or by crook she's going to make the lyrics fit into the song.
Oh, she is not changing those lines.
But you know, that is one of the things that I like, because I love that little bit of roughness. The fact that it's like, this isn't perfect. This is what I've made, and this is what you're getting. And I think Nadine's absolutely right when she talks about how it can start to sound a little bit samey. And I think probably by the time that I got to, I think it was Sandbox Love is in the second half or halfway through side two on the album. But then you get to Nemesis, which is at the very end. It's 6 minutes, and suddenly she goes into this weird dance vibe. And it's because it's her, it's such a revelation. And I think it's a positive one as well. And it brought me back to the album. And it kind of made me then very happy then to get to Pedestal at the very end.
Stars out of 5 for you, Simon.
I'm going to give this 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5. And from you, Nadine?
3, but like I said, it could be me.
It's not you, Alanis, it's me. So now, the second album is Who the Power by Lila Moss. Simon, this is the second album from Lila Moss. And tell us a little bit about her. She is usually associated with a band, Duke Spirit, but this is her second solo album.
Yeah, so the Duke Spirit have been around. They've been around for 15 years, I think, at this stage, and released 3 or 4 albums and would be kind of very well known within the indie fraternity, but never made the big breakthrough. So she went off then in 2018 and decided she's going to do some solo stuff, or stuff with her partner, who's also in the Duke Spirit. And the first album that she released was quite, I'm not going to say singer-songwritery, but very much pared back version of what the Duke Spirit was, so that I think people had an expectation when this album came out that it might sound something similar, but it's very much back to the more form, the more full band sort of an album.
She talks about being very concerned about the planet, Nadine.
Yeah, she does. I mean, so there's some themes kind of winding their way through here. She went on a retreat, actually, before around the time of the making of the record. And also she became a mother. And I think those facts kind of inform the lyrics on the record. You know, she writes about how nothing's permanent on a track like Always Sliding. And you get this sense that actually there's kind of an anger rippling through the album and a kind of an urgency. One of the things that she said about becoming a mother was that she wasn't going to make an album if it was just content for content's sake. She wanted to make something that functioned as a statement about what she believed and that it had to be worth getting into studio for. That it couldn't just be, oh, look, I'm doing another thing because this is the kind of thing that I do. And you do get that sense from the record that it's brooding, that it's contemplative. Her lyrics wouldn't be as direct as Alanis's. You know, it's a lot more atmospheric and she uses kind of vaguer words. But nonetheless, you do come away from this feeling as though this writer, this singer, this artist has a kind of the blood is boiling in parts of this record.
Yes, and unlike Alanis, she doesn't seem to like verbs. One of the standout tracks is the single Atoms At Me. So let's have a listen to that. Atoms At Me from Who The Power by Lila Moss. Simon, do you think that track's a good indicator of what the album is about when she sings there, I need to break out in the open?
Yeah, I think so, because I do think, yeah, there is that little bit of pent up anger that's in there, as Nadine said, and talking about, like, she's talking about how she reckons we could be close to the end of the planet, but if we want to do it, we might as well go out with a bang. And that's what she sings about an awful lot on this. And there's a really interesting scene that's going on at the moment, and it's the likes of her and Nadine Shah and Roisin Murphy and people like that, who were singing in a sort of a vaguely sort of a similar style. But it's really, really good stuff. And it is, and it's great to hear that there is that, you know, that bit of wrath, that bit of anger that's there and that bit of impatience. And that can only be a good thing.
Yeah, Nadine Shah, that we reviewed fairly recently on the programme. Nadine, do you think, I mean, is that a dance track?
I think it's a track that I found myself listening to the album and thinking, oh, I'd love to hear this at 3 a.m. at the Body and Soul stage and Electric Picnic, because it's exactly the time that you'd have had the big act, like you'd have had the Chemical Brothers or whatever on the main stage, and then you'd go for your kind of wind down moment to an electro artist that was a little bit more moody, low key, melancholic, but still with that throbbing kind of beat, so that people would be sort of, just before they get, I don't want to get all nostalgic about Electric Picnic.
Oh,
here,
I'm there, keep going.
But, you know, before people go back into their tents or whatever. And it's that kind of artist where it's like you're sort of bopping away, but it's a wind down moment. So it's that lovely sort of in-betweener. And I think she would be a tremendous artist on a stage like that.
I think you liked White Feather as well.
Yeah. And I mean, generally speaking, I thought the quality of the album throughout was pretty strong. I mean, I suppose, you know, one of the things about her that she actually almost underplays on this record in a way is quite how strong and good her vocal is, because she's talked in interviews about how herself and her partner, who's also her producer, he's a romantic partner, and her producer Toby Butler, they did a lot of playing around with vintage synths and drum machines, and they built up this really interesting sonic template that acts as this backdrop for the sound. And probably because of that, you're very aware all the time of the atmospherics and the droney quality and the bass, so sometimes you're not actually thinking about what a great singer she is, but she actually has a really beautiful vocal with very good range.
So let's listen to White Feather. So that's White Feather from Who The Power by Lila Moss. Simon, out of five.
I really liked this album, and it's one of the things, even listening to that song on the headphones, just as it was playing out there, is the bass on the drums on it. And you can tell that the Toby Butler was the bass player of the Jukespear, because there's loads of drumming and it sounds great. So being consistent, I'm giving this 4 out of 5 as well.
4 out of 5. And from you, Nadine?
I'll go 3.5.
3.5. For that's from Who the Power by Lila Moss. The third album we have is The Dirt and the Stars by Mary Chapin Carpenter. Simon, she wrote this before lockdown, but I think she's been doing a lot of online performances for fans during lockdown. Do you think that this is an album that will give comfort to people in these very strange times we're in, stranger as the night goes on?
Absolutely, yes, yeah. And that's one of those things, because I listened to the album before I read anything about it, you know. I listened to it, kind of went, this really is a good album for our times, you know, for what is going on. And it was only then, when I went to read about it later on, I discovered that a lot of the songs were actually written last year. And it was only then when they brought them, I think it was recorded in Peter Gabriel's studio, but it was still recorded quite some time ago. And it's interesting that she has decided that she is going to keep on. She wanted to perform these songs. This is, I think, album number 17. She's been recording for more than 30 years now. And but that people, there's still a demand for her, and that she still feels that she's got a lot to say. And what has always been something that has always gone along with Mary Chapin Carpenter is that she should be the darling of country music radio in the US in particular. But because she also says stuff, it was always one of the things that held her back. And I think probably for the first 10 years of her career, maybe that was something she worried about. But she's got to the point now, whether it be with her online performances that you mentioned or with an album like this, where it's like, I don't care. I have things to say and I'm saying them.
Yes, yes. She's American Stooge and other songs on this album that'll upset people, I'm sure. But let's let's play the title track. It's called The Dirt and the Stars.
Everything you'll ever know in the choruses, everything that made you whole, everything that broke your heart, whatever called you by your soul, and piece by piece took you apart. Every spark you ever chased, all the faith, love robbed you.
That's The Dirt and the Stars, the title track from Mary Chapin Carpenter's new album. Nadine, it's a very different sound to Alanis Morissette, isn't it?
It really is. I was thinking about just listening to it there. You know, Alanis spends a lot of time in music kind of complaining, you know, like it's very, you know, sort of almost like she's written a column and she set it to music and she's like, here's another thing that I am not happy
yes,
about.
Yes, very much so, yes.
Whereas Mary Chapin Carpenter, for me at least, I love the way that when you even listen to the nuance in her vocal, there's such great tenderness in it. And her lyrics are so observational. You know, there's one song where she just sings, I'm 17 and in the car, the summer night sticks to my skin, beer gone to my head. And the thing is, those are very, very, very simple lines, but they catapult you right into a scene and they make you feel like you're part of something, like you're with her. And I love that about it. And I thought that the track you just played, actually, it's about 7 minutes long and it's got a really long guitar part at the end by her longtime guitarist, Duke Levine. And it's that kind of confidence that she would create a track that's 7 minutes, 7 minutes long, that she's just thinking to herself, well, I'll do this because I'm this far into my career and I will say and do and play what I want. And similarly, you mentioned the track American Stooge. I mean, the lyrics on that are pretty, you know, they're pretty biting, actually. You know, she says, you know, she's talking about, I think, possibly Lindsey Graham, but she's singing about how a fork in the road, power in his left and conscience on his right, he's proud to be your favourite hypocrite. And it's kind of an interesting dimension to her as well, that she's willing to go not exactly into the outright complaining territory, but she is sort of saying this is where we're at in America.
Stars out of 5 from you, Nadine, for Mary Chapin Carpenter?
3.5.
3.5. And for you, Simon?
I'm obviously feeling generous this evening. No, I really enjoyed this, and I think Mary Chapin Carpenter is actually an important voice. So I'm going to give her a 4 as well.
4 out of 5. Well, Nadine O'Regan and Simon Marr, thank you. Alanis Morissette's album is Such Pretty Forks in the Road. Lila Moss is Who the Power. And Mary Chapin Carpenter, The Dirt and the Stars. That's it for this week's Arena. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields were the researchers. Kieran Cullen was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. And the programme was produced by Sinead Egan.